Thank you very much. I want to thank both the CREATE team for inviting me, but I want to thank all of you who have the stamina to stay through a number of glitches and the terrible situation that computer companies still subject us to their monolingualism. So I will also try to run through the first part of my presentation because actually, being the last person, I felt that I needed to do something that would really convey the importance of the theme that unites CREATE. And so I have brought a couple of video clips to show and the ability for all of us to walk into classrooms and to see enacted what we are talking about, I think will overcompensate, even if I don't get to my second part. Because as you know, we have a very strict timekeeper. So there are two main goals. I have a little bit of a psychotic presentation. The first part is really talking about the value of oral engagement in the development of disciplinary literacy for English learners. And I want to present a continuum of how that goes and illustrate it with the video clips. And then the second part has to do actually with a very comprehensive and large and very scary evaluation of the work that my teammates and I have developed. And it's scary because it's over 3 years. I cannot share any results with you because the evaluators have been sworn that they will not actually share any ongoing results until the whole study is done. And we are entering our third and final year. So hopefully we will have a CREATE next year, and then I'll be able to share some results with you at the time, but I want, if I have time, to explain some of the context of that evaluation and actually some of the challenges of that evaluation, both presented from the point of view of the implementers, that is my teammates and I, and from the point of view of the evaluators with whom we have talked extensively. The end goal of education is to produce literate individuals. So literacy is really our goal. And literacy is absolutely intertwined with language development. And being literate is more than simply, as has already been explained, being able to read and understand the message. But it actually entails understanding what is the messenger's position with regards to what the messenger is saying, what the messenger is trying to get us to do, and being able to respond appropriately. So we're not just talking about words, we are really talking about a whole complex world that needs to be brought to the classroom to produce citizens, as Sylvia said, who act responsibly in a social context. Because school knowledge becomes increasingly specialized, then literacy, as we move from the lower elementary grades through middle school and high school, becomes increasingly discipline-specific. And therefore, the language required to engage in literacy events takes slightly different characteristics and sometimes major differences across these disciplines. The way, for example, in which we substantiate a position and the kinds of warrants that we bring to support that position look very different in mathematics than they do in social studies. And so that is really a massive endeavor for teachers who may be really good at teaching social studies, but for whom language is like the air we breathe. They breathe it, but they cannot explain it scientifically. And so we have a number of problems really facing the disciplinary development of rich generative literacies in second language learners. Becoming literate in an L2, or actually even in our L1s, is really an ongoing process. We don't just learn the academic uses of a language once, and now we have them, and we tend to be rather shocked as we move from high school to a bachelor's degree, and as we move from a bachelor's degree to a master's program, and then to the even more rarefied world of PhDs. And we need to keep really honing and developing our skills as we move through a wide variety of texts. that are characterized by conciseness, precision, and I will come back to this. The process then consists not only of constructing meaning through interaction and involvement with a wide variety of texts, but if teachers are going to really usher students into the communities of critical readers that they want them to be, then teachers need to be able to construct those invitations and support them in ways that indeed develop what we want students to have. So building academic repertoires, linguistic repertoires, requires that there is a very conscious attention and very deliberate investment by both teachers, so the issue of teacher professional development, what that should look like, and by students who need to explicitly be told, kids, this is going to be tough today, and we'll just develop our stamina today. But tomorrow it'll be so much easier because we'll go over the major climb today, and tomorrow we'll just walk a plateau. Things like that teachers need to do that go beyond the real understanding of the complexity of the task, but that also position them as individuals who truly believe their students are capable of becoming who they model and even beyond the individuals that they are. In this activity, unfortunately, as I like to say, literacy is not an equal opportunity activity. And the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And so the more students bring to a literacy engagement, the more they derive from that engagement. And so I would like to move on into explaining from a couple of texts. And I do apologize, you don't have it in your handout, but since we're all going to be sending Create our final PowerPoints, you will get it. But all I want to illustrate is this way in which discipline-related language involves conciseness, preciseness, and the discussion of more complex ideas and concepts. So look at this little text taken from a high school book. Extended drought caused the crops to fail, resulting in a widespread famine and many deaths, especially among the children and elderly. One sentence, very condensed. Is it a matter of just vocabulary understanding this? Is it, and we've been discussing, and I'm really happy that these two main criteria have emerged. It's about vocabulary, it's also about background knowledge. But it's also about unpacking the density of academic language. Because if we really want to understand what this is, it would take several clauses to signal the relationships that are established between and across ideas, to understand the way in which logical references are presented and carried out through just one sentence. And so we would need to say things like, there was no rain for a very long time, etc., etc. You will have it. But this is just one way of illustrating what academic texts do with increasing rigor. And that is, for example, they nominalize, so whole sets of actions become a noun. And it is a noun that moves at a higher level of abstraction, encapsulating all kinds of meaning components. And so it's very important to work with students in helping them unpack these complexities and really engaging them in a metalinguistic awareness as they move through their understanding of the differences of texts. So what's the role of oral language in this endeavor? Oral language is very important because it enables students to use what they have, especially in the case, for example, of long-term English learners that, as we saw, have oral skills, to use the resources that they have and at the same time to tackle academic complexity. So they use everyday language in conversation, talking about academic topics, and increasingly they move into talking about academic topics in academic ways. But I will come back to that. Language, oral language, the ability for students to engage in discussing ideas, problematizing them, etc., allows learners to make that reasoning transparent. Because remember, the reasoning, as we move into academic expression, is going to be elliptical, right? And so when you're talking, you are really making transparent the different links, the different arguments that you're bringing forth, and you know that as you move into more academic expressions, then it's going to be abstracted. Furthermore, it helps students, it's a way, it's a vehicle for really using words such as morphology, syntax, etc., as you will see later on in one of the videos. It also helps learners develop a personal voice, because for all of us who work in a second language, we know that there was a horrible moment in our lives where we sounded fake, where we sounded almost mentally retarded, and where we just felt that at the age of 20, I didn't sound like the brilliant 20-year-old that I was in Spanish, but I sounded more like a 7-year-old, and I was in college, right? And so having the ability to talk about academic issues begins to develop a sense of voice in students as somebody who engages in intellectual activity. And of course, it serves as auto-input in the sense that when we hear ourselves, we say, oh no, that didn't sound right. And many times we self-correct, right? In fact, in yesterday's transcript, we saw that the student self-corrects when he reads, mispronounces brasero, right? And so we sound, and we say, oh, and sometimes we're sounding ourselves, and we say, wow, that sounded really impressive, right? We may not communicate it to others, but just think of how our identity as second academic language users develops over time. So what is the role of teachers? The role of teachers is to construct invitations that are enticing, that are powerful, that are rigorous, but invitations that maximize the opportunities for each and every student to engage in substantive discussions about the topic at hand. Is that a tough issue? We've all been complaining about that. And it's nothing new. I mean, there's that wonderful 1975 book of Dan Lorty called School Teacher, where precisely what he expresses about the time is the failure of teachers to abdicate the role as absolute controllers of what goes on in class. So being able to change teachers into teachers who can think about where do I want my students at the end of this class, and therefore what should I be engaging them in so that we get there, requires a lot of professional development. And it requires that teachers become aware of things that they control extremely well but don't know about, and that they focus initially on students' oral fluency. And what that means is that students present their ideas in ways that flow more or less at natural speed, and that they do not worry first about accuracy, how correct the verb tense is, or whether the preposition is wrong or right, and that they do not worry at first about issues of complexity, vocabulary richness, or the ability to weave two simple phrases into an embedded or a complex sentence. That is equally important, but it must come after students express their ideas. Because something that tends to happen in middle and high schools is students pour out their ideas, and they get back papers saying, you missed the past tense, watch out spelling, and nobody responds to students' ideas. And after we do this to students in middle and high school, when they get to the university, writing instructors complain, they don't trust their ideas. How do I get them to trust their ideas? But of course, if they have been the victims of subtracting schooling, then it is understandable that by the time they've gone through this, they wouldn't have it. Now, my little point of controversy. Vocabulary development. A lot has been talked today and yesterday about vocabulary development. And I agree, vocabulary development is important. However, I think vocabulary development sits within larger linguistic issues that frame how people work to communicate with each other. And the shift in registers, and I'll come back to the notion of registers, that students go through as they move from the neighborhood to school, to the math classroom, to the social studies classroom, are shifts that we really need to help students navigate. And adolescents are at a prime age, oh, I was worried, she's getting up, at a prime age to really be... to be metacognitive. They are metacognitive about how others behave, how others dress, how I dress, how I talk. And so why can't we capitalize on the wonderful strengths and the real interest that adolescents have about finding who they are, how they perform, to move it into the world of language? Wherever that has been done well, I assure you, and you will see evidence of it, it works just beautifully. Oh, I wanted to give specifics, but you read them, right? That lists and all of that. Never mind. So what about academic uses of English or of any other language? Academic uses of any language involve a constellation of features that together construct texts. And they are very difficult for students because there are three main elements that are involved. The first one is the field of knowledge, which is the domain or the subject matter, what the content, right? Geography, volcanoes, whatever. The second one is the tenor, because every text positions the writer as somebody in a relationship with a reader or in a relationship with an interlocutor. And so, for example, some texts position listeners in very symmetrical contexts. If you say, hi, how are you? I haven't seen you. But some ways of saying hello position listeners in asymmetrical relationships. Hey, you, bring me that. Then it's immediate. There's the asymmetry, right? And students can understand this. They do understand it in their everyday lives. Why shouldn't they understand it about texts? And finally, the modes. The modes are, is it, for example, a letter? Or is it rather an essay? These multiple variations result in academic registers. And what registers are the linguistic variations that occur according to contexts of use. Now, yesterday, David asked an excellent question. And his question was, can we explicitly teach language, language form, language structure to students? Guess what? It's being done in Australia. It has been done. This diagram comes from a wonderful book by Beverly Derevyanka that dates to 1990. And we all know that in Australia and in Canada, immigrant students, first generation, perform very close to the native population, and second generation English learners outperform the native speaking population. So if we want more evidence of results that this works, that there is a lot of evidence. So the point here is that teachers need to work explaining to students what is the genre of the text we are going to look at. And they work exploring, for example, what is the purpose of telling a story? Why do we tell people stories? Or why do we describe things to people? Or why do we do? And that after that, we need to be concerned about what is the subject matter or the specific meaning domain we are working on? What is the tenor? So what kinds of relationships are we, is the text constructing, and what is the channel? And as a result of that, we get a register, and the register, of course, manifests itself in text. And this text may be oral, this text may be written. So I want to move now into this continuum. Rather than talking about this language that is everyday language, and there is an academic language, we really can look at the continuum in another way, which is this text is a little bit more spoken. So it has features of interactive language, and or it moves into more written. In other words, it's denser, it is more abstract. It has gone through those processes that we know that academic texts engage in. So the development of student ability to move through this continuum cannot be tracked from day to day, but it needs to be tracked over units of work. And sometimes these units of work are thematic units that may take 5 weeks, or sometimes they are simply smaller units that take 4 days. And there I go to my examples. The first example comes from a 9th, 10th grade combination class. The teacher is Tony DeFazio, a wonderful teacher. And he is working on the third day of a 5-week unit. His students that you will see are actually, let me start inserting this because now that I remember, it takes time for it to work. The students are in a range of having been in the United States actually 3.5 weeks, one student. And the student that speaks the most English, and we will see her, a girl called Lavinia in a red sweater, having been in the United States almost 2.5 years. What Tony is working on having his students explore, once again, another example that explorations on language are fascinating to teenagers, and especially if they come from other languages, right? Because it's a natural. You're always saying, why do you say things like that when we say them like this? And so that's, you know, already an important point. But this is day 3 of the first week, which is what is language? And he's inviting students after 2 days, I mean 2 classes, which are just 1 hour and 10 minutes, of exploring language in general, to begin writing about what they learned in a letter to somebody. So you see here, we have a topic. The field is very academic and very complex, but the way of using it is more or less conversational. And so we are going to see he invites 5 students to write their beginnings in big butcher paper, and he comments on them, but we're only going to see 2 of those. And you have the transcript, not the best transcript, because I goofed off when I emailed my transcripts. I apologize for that. But, you know, it's a fair enough transcript. Huh?
When we're paying attention to these 5, we'll give us an idea about how different people started and where they think they're going to go. Okay?
I'm writing this letter to you because I want to give you some advice about writing. I know you're a big person, so I'm going to give you some advice of my language from my own experience. First things first, before going to the main part, I want to tell you where everything is.
And it's a she weeps, right?
Since there aren't any exact definitions for languages, I'm going to tell you what language is.
Can you hear?
Language is
very nice beginning. Now you're so quiet today, right? How did she start? She's going to tell people from her own what? Experience. Alright, that's one way you can start something, an experience that's important to you. And that's what she's going to do. She's going to show, I think, at least from what she said, how learning linguistics is helping her to learn English. Okay. You sure?
Can you kind of explain for learning linguistics and how you define a language? Every language has its characteristics, and some of them are sounds, alphabet, grammar, and words. And also animals have their own language. They communicate by sounds, smell.
Okay, and that's as far as you got, right? Where do you think you might go next with that?
I think we're going to talk a little more about the animals' communication. And then we're going to start with comparing language, our language and English.
Okay, so what you're trying to do is to give people what, ladies and gentlemen?
Directions.
Go ahead. Good. Pause. Pause. Go. Characteristic or E, X, A.
Example.
Example. All right? I'm going to be looking for this. I'm going to be looking for that. The same thing you look for.
The way we learn our first language is by hearing, repeating, and remembering. We learn our second language by studying, also hearing and repeating, and being in a way forced to do it if you are in another country. I found from my research that animal communication is not a language. Animal communication is different from the human communication because in case of dolphins, they communicate through ultrasonic pulses that cannot be heard by the human ear. I don't think that their language is better than others. This is about it because I do not have enough time, but I appreciate that you teach me these things and I consider you the best teacher that I ever had.
Very nice start.
Animal communication is not a language.
It is a language. That's what I think. Because they communicate.
But they don't speak.
You can have words,
language. Lavinia is saying it's not. What do you think is would be a way to help them resolve that argument in their right?
So you see how Julio mixes conversational features, you know what I'm saying, and with use of quite sophisticated concepts and complex language. And so this would be at the beginning of the continuum. I cannot do two things at the same time. Too old. So we see here how Tony invites students to write letters. At the end of each week, they will have a full-fledged letter. But this is his first unit of the year. By the end of the year, those letters will be transformed into academic essays. And so you see how a teacher that really understands the value of showing, expecting a lot from students, but at the same time supporting them in non-prescriptive ways, because he hasn't given them a format, but he wants students to build the coherence of the text. The second example is a middle school example. I need to say that this first video is a video of a teacher that, after a long study, I found was superb. We learned a lot from Tony. He's a teacher at the International High School at La Guardia Community College. Actually, he just retired, and wonderfully for us, he works with my team now. So it's the only time when I'm happy somebody retires. This second teacher is a teacher very much like most teachers in America. Very caring, very passionate, really excited about what she has to teach. But you're going to see her in the second year of professional development, where she has engaged in a lot of work with us, 6 days of professional development 1 year, 4 coaching sessions. And she is truly letting kids work on their own and structuring the activity instead. So kids are in their third day of a 45-minute lessons. So in the third day of a 4-day study of Robert Frost. And so the first day they did a biography of Frost, and then they started reading The Road Not Taken, and now they have read it interactively, really beautifully, but we cannot see that. And now the task you're going to see is a task where the teacher gives them exactly 12 minutes. You have 12 minutes. And in 12 minutes, working collaboratively at your tables in fours, you're going to be assigned a stanza in The Road Not Taken, of The Road Not Taken, and you will have to present a visual of that stanza that encapsulates the main idea, and you will do that by producing a visual. There are 4 components. You produce a visual, you create a phrase of your own that summarizes the main idea. You choose an appropriate quote from that stanza that also reinforces how the poet feels or what he's trying to convey, and finally, some symbolic element. And so you're going to see, and this is a little bit longish, you also have the transcript, and you may want to refer to the transcript because there's a little bit more noise in this class since everybody's working at the same time.
Thank you.
I am so sorry. Timing. I know. Can we see? It's only 2 more minutes. No, I quit. Okay. You actually have the transcript. The beautiful thing about this interaction is that the girl has misunderstood the assignment, and so she's added extra difficulty by insisting that their original phrase has to rhyme. And so at that point, they first check the dictionary, and they cannot find anything, and they go and bring the teacher. So now the teacher comes, and so they say, I'm Robert Frost, I have a path to choose. I might choose right, or I, and the teacher says, maybe wrong. And she said, no, it has to rhyme. And so the teacher said, oh, it has to rhyme? Oh, and she says, well, rhyme, it has to rhyme. And then she says, what about using a homophone? And so what's a homophone of I might be right? And so one student says, right. And she says, okay. And then the boy that has been silent jumps up and says, I might choose the right that will help me write. And so, and then, of course, the video ends with them presenting very proudly, and they announce, we used a homophone. So now they have appropriated the language, right? Because it came totally spontaneously. I think, since I have no more time, I apologize, but I just want to really reiterate the fact that engaging students in sustained oral interaction is a very complex task. It requires that teachers first understand the value of carefully structuring an activity, timing it right, offering the right supports, and staying away. And students will make mistakes. In fact, when they present, she will see that they have misinterpreted the road less traveled because it's less, it's shorter. And so now, in the final day, she can go back and point what that means, right? But it's in the performance that the teacher really comes in and intervenes, because why stop the furious creativity and the stamina these students show? Now, the camera focused on this group for the 4 days of the unit, but there was another camera focused on another group of four, and similar processes emerge. But this is after we have worked with a teacher for a year and a half, and then eventually she actually will be wonderful and we'll be able to scale up the work. The evaluation you can read, and if you have questions, I will be delighted to answer emails. So please email me with questions. I hope it's more or less self-explanatory there. Thank you very much, and I thank you.